We basically have had a chance the last few days to attend the three very drawn-out keynotes for the Snapdragon 865, Snapdragon 765, Snapdragon 765G, and their chips, their phone chips. And so there's nothing really, I mean,
what's
I don't
the
know
takeaway?
What the main, takeaway. Yeah, let's do the big takeaway before I try guess get a little bit more specific on some of these things. The biggest takeaway is that this is the chip that is going to be in the Google Pixel 5 and the Samsung Galaxy S11 and everything else. So pretty much every premium phone next year is going to have this chip. And so really, I think the main takeaway is, like, I mean, for me and for, I guess, 9to5 Google and kind of what we talk about and what we focus on, we kind of learned a little bit about the Google Pixel 5 spec sheet this week. we know what GPU the Google Pixel 5 is going to have. We know what CPU it's going to have. We know how that CPU compares to this year, which I guess we can start with CPU and GPU stuff, which is nothing's really changing in terms of kind of the mobile CPU competitive landscape, which there isn't really a competitive landscape, and that might be part of the problem. as we know, Intel tried to enter into the smartphone system on a chip game a while ago, and that didn't pan out as it was to be expected. So this chip is, I think, 25% more efficient in terms of, I guess, power consumption, and it is a little bit faster. I could find the exact numbers, but I don't think most people probably care.
And at the same time, like, this is the state of the chips are pretty good as is. Like, there's no, because smartphones are in that place where it's good enough. Performance is, did Google even mention what chip the Pixel 4 is running for the past several generations now? I don't think they have.
No, it's just been a spec sheet bullet point. And yeah, it's not really even a talking point. And yeah, you're right. It's like, the chips since probably the 835 have not really changed much year over year in terms of performance, unless you're really into very specific use cases. Like, if you're a really, really hardcore gamer or something, you know, like, there are reasons to have newer phones if you have those kind of specific cases. But I mean, the same goes for an Apple side of things too. It's like an iPhone 8 running iOS 13 is not that much different from an iPhone 11. And that's because the way we use our phones just isn't changing that much year over year. And so the performance gains on the CPU side, especially, is not it's not really important. But they're there. So I guess that's the thing is Snapdragon, or I keep calling them Snapdragon, Qualcomm saying that this new Adreno 650 GPU is 20% faster than last year's chip. One of the really interesting things this year that they're doing, as of the 865 platform, is that they will be updating GPU drivers via the Play Store, which is never been done before. And I don't know, my instinct, and maybe this is totally wrong, but my instinct was to think, so maybe they're going to ship buggy drivers out the gate. It's like every time something becomes updatable via the Play Store, I start to wonder, like, is software, or is the quality and is release, I guess, you know, QA, is QA going to slip? Is release quality going to slip if it's really easy to just patch things? I don't know if that's necessarily the case here, because there's obviously a certain standard they have to meet at launch with any of these phones. But I guess the upside is that if there's a specific game that becomes really popular. I mean, I'm thinking, like, the last couple of years, if they had been able to update GPU drivers, you know, Fortnite was easily the most popular mobile game. It's like, in that case, you know, if they found that they could optimize the GPU drivers for that game, which was abundantly popular, and they wouldn't have been able to do it, at least not easily. And now GPU drivers will be updatable very easily, just depending on the circumstances. I doubt that's going to mean, you know, weekly GPU updates, but it's closer to being, you know, a desktop-esque kind of platform. So yeah, that's the CPU and GPU side of things. And I guess that kind of connects to, well, you know, if the year over year CPU and GPU bumps don't really matter because the way we use our phones isn't really changing. What kinds of things could change the way we use our phones that might actually require faster single score or single core benchmark scores? And I guess one of the answers might be the kind of use cases that come out of the adoption of 5G, which 5G is really, I mean, I think the big takeaway of this week is, hey, cool. Now we know a lot about what the, you know, the major Android flagships next year are going to have in them. Yeah. But what does that mean? And what that means, the big thing, the big takeaway, the big thing that that means this year is 5G. So these chips, all three of them will be 5G supporting. I mean,
they require the 865.
Right. Yeah. So the 865 is not going to be an integrated solution just yet. But interestingly, the mid-rangers, the 765 and the 765G will be integrated solutions with the 5G chips. So yeah, I mean, I'm not a chip guy, so I don't know exactly. I wouldn't be able to, you know, give you detailed analysis on what that's going to mean, for, you know, for smartphone vendors next year. But I think the big story here is that, you know, these vendors will be using most parts of this modular kind of 865 and 5G system, which means most, if not all, 865 phones that launch next year will have 5G. What
are they ready for that? It does seem to, I'm of the opinion that it's too early for 5G even next year. I know a lot of the discussion this year was many flagships OEMs releasing additional 5G versions of their smartphones. The Note, the S10 come to mind, but I do wonder whether this technology is ready in terms of
OnePlus 7T.
Yeah, the McLaren edition.
Yeah, what do you mean by the technology is ready? Are you saying the state of the network infrastructure?
Both twofold, both the state of the network infrastructure. Let's take Google as an example. How widely rolled out will it be by next October? And two, the battery life concerns and the battery life impact of running those specific radios needed to get to 5G and millimeter wave technology specifically. That question is there, and I don't know whether this upcoming generation of phones, starting with, I guess, the S10 in February or the S11 in February or March and ending with the Pixel 5, will suffer as a result of this technology being pushed so hard right now.
Yeah, I'm not sure how it's going to affect on the battery side of things. There's so much there's just so much confusion. There's so much to talk about with 5G that, like, this week is actually, honestly, if I'm completely honest, this is the first week that I've actually tried to start digging in and try to understand some of these things. You know, I've been aware of you know, the 5G rollout for years now, especially with, you know, as you mentioned, the flagship phones that launched last year that were the 5G variants of the main, you know, the main lines. But yeah, it's like, I don't know. There's definitely a messaging. I mean, before I get into, you know, my thoughts on the battery concerns or whether or not the technology is ready, I just think it needs to be mentioned that 5G is just so confusing from a consumer messaging standpoint. Like, there's two major kind of categories of 5G, and they're being deployed by different companies, and they mean completely different things. And so and they're both being branded as 5G, and Snapdragon's A65 5G chip will support both. And one is, you know, sub 6, basically 5G, which is 5G bandwidth under 6 gigahertz, right? And then there's millimeter wave, which is way, way up the spectrum. And those are completely different things. Like, sub 6 5G is basically going to mean, practically speaking for consumers, it's just basically going to be a slightly better version of 4G. It seems like that's what it's going to mean, although I've heard anecdotally that as of today, in many cases, in many places, based on the current state, the current state of the infrastructure, that's not even the case. That's better. Just for an example, you know, T-Mobile has rolled out a lot of their sub 6 5G network in Hawaii, and I've heard anecdotally from some people this week even that the 4G LTE from T-Mobile is better here than their current 5G network setups in certain places that are supposed to be 5G compatible. So so there's that, and then there's millimeter wave, which is what Verizon. I mean, so AT&T, I think AT&T and Verizon are both playing with millimeter wave or rolling out millimeter wave in stadiums and some urban areas, and T-Mobile's primarily doing sub six at the moment. And Verizon side of things, they only have 5G millimeter wave on Maui right now, and it's literally just at this hotel. Like this is the place that you could get 5G in all of Hawaii if you have a Verizon as your carrier. So yeah, it's just really confusing. I think like it's really confusing just to understand, you know, which carrier is going to have which kind of 5G, which carrier has which access to which bands, and which carrier has, you know, which infrastructure. And, you know, it's like, it's not going to be as simple as the 3G to 4G move, which wasn't even simple in the first place. But this one's going to be even more convoluted. But yeah, I mean, on the technology readiness side, I mean, I think I just spoke to some of those things, which is, as of today, it's absolutely pointless to own a 5G compatible phone, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. There's exceptions to that. And that those exceptions are some stadiums and when, you know, some very dense urban centers, and the Grand Wailea in Maui, Hawaii. To address your thought on the battery side of things before I let you, you know, continue is just, I feel like given that that's true, are the phones that shipped in 2020 being 5G ready? Is that really going to have an impact on battery life if those phones are primarily using their 4G radios 90% of the time anyway? I feel like the way that it's rolling out so gradually and so slowly is actually going to mitigate a lot of concerns and a lot of problems.
That's fair. That's very true.
Because, you know, yeah, I mean, if suddenly, you know, the Note 10 is suddenly running its millimeter wave 5G radio 24/7 instead of the 4G one, which would only be the case for less than 1% of Note whatever number it is, 5G buyers, you know, that would be a problem. But since the vast majority of people are going to have 5G ready phones in their hands while still primarily only using 4G networks, I don't think it'll matter for that part of it. That's only one aspect of the picture though.
So yeah, I guess relate to that. So the US carrier, let's again taking the US as an example, the US carriers and Qualcomm and the chip maker are heavily pushing this. Does that necessarily mean that OEMs are going to like make this a central selling point of their phones? What was the Qualcomm's like mood towards that during the keynotes? Did they just cite the usual, you'll start seeing these chips in the markets very quickly? Or
yeah, and for that matter, we literally the day of the announcement, I could get into this, but the first day keynote was basically, this is the Snapdragon 865. It exists and it will be 5G. And they detailed some things, but they didn't really go deep on it. Which is kind of, I think kind of like Qualcomm trying to double dip on coverage a little bit, because they're basically pushing out two press releases for the same product over the course of 2 days. But yeah, I mean, actually on that first day, we got confirmations that some of these makers are already saying, yeah, our flagship phones next year will be 5G ready with the Snapdragon 865. I don't think that we will see, first of all, I have to be honest and say, I don't know if it's possible for a phone to launch with the 865 and not support 5G.
Yes.
I think it's possible the other way around for sure. I mean, we know that Apple is going to be using Qualcomm's 5G. Mm-hmm. Well, I think we think that Apple's going to be using Qualcomm's 5G radios,
very strong,
but not their system on a chip.
Absolutely not.
Right. And is it, I mean, can they do the 865 without making it 5G compatible?
No. That's they're pushing joint adoption of these platforms, which is really.
Exactly. And that's, I mean, so even this past Monday, we got direct confirmation from I guess the smartphone makers that you would expect would be willing to talk, because they're probably just, you know, wanting to take advantage of every positive PR opportunity they can. Whereas, you know, the others, Samsung and Google, and I guess those are really the two main ones. Google and Samsung are not saying anything about whether or not they're doing anything with the 865, because they don't need to say anything. But Xiaomi and Oppo and Motorola and HMD, which is Nokia, all confirmed that they're going to be adopting either the 865, three of those were directly confirming, yeah, we're going to do a flagship phone very soon with the 865. I know Xiaomi said, I quote, in 2020 Q1, so, you know, in the next month or two, Xiaomi is going to announce the Mi 10, which is going to be one of the world's first phones to feature the Snapdragon 865. I think the implication there was that the Mi 10 will be a 5G phone by default. I also think the same is true of Oppo. Oppo said Oppo will launch its flagship product using the Snapdragon 865 in 2020 Q1. So Oppo is basically matching Xiaomi's announcement there. And they did mention specifically 5G. They said together bringing a faster and superior 5G experience to users. And they mentioned 5G a bunch of other times. And then a Lenovo, which is Motorola in this case. Motorola says, we will continue to lead the 5G area with our expanded lineup of 5G solutions in 2020, driven by the high-performing Snapdragon 765 and 865. So those three directly confirmed that they will be doing flagship 865 phones with 5G. And HMD Global, aka Nokia, says they're using the Snapdragon 765 for one of their phones, which will also be a quote, future-proof 5G experience. So not only does it seem like every single maker that's launching premium 865 smartphones in 2020 will be 5G phones, it seems like there's going to be lots of mid-range 5G phones, which that's an interesting, I mean, that's a crazy fast turnaround from this past year. This past year was, not only do the premium flagships not have 5G, you need to pay a premium to get the 5G versions if you want to be a super early adopter. To it now seems like Nokia might have a $400 phone that has 5G in 2020. Which, you know, that's a crazy, you know, it seems that's what I read on the situation, is that every single phone, pretty much, I mean, every notable phone that launches next year is going to be 5G ready. Name your phone, whichever phone it is that you're looking forward to buying in 2020. If you're looking forward to buy a phone in 2020, it's probably going to have 5G. Will that matter for you? If you're on T-Mobile, chances are you will have a chance that their sub-6 network will, in some areas, probably be better than their 4G network. If you live in New York City, in certain boroughs of New York City, you'll be able to use Verizon's millimeter wave network. If you're at an NFL football game at one of the top 12 stadiums in the country on AT&T or Verizon, you'll be able to use your 5G phone. It's very, very early days, early days, TM. But yeah, it seems like it's happening. This is the Ron Paul, like, it's happening GIF moment for 5G. I think that's my big takeaway for this week at Snapdragon Tech Summit. But the other question I think to be had is, let's say the network was completely mature tomorrow. How many 5G use cases have actually proven themselves as of today? None. Like,
none.
Having access to 5G millimeter wave on your Galaxy S11 in Brooklyn is not going to change how you experience scrolling through Instagram. And
yeah, it's not.
It's not going to change 99% of the things that you currently do on your phone. And that's the big question mark. To me, that's even at this point an even bigger question mark than network readiness or battery life concerns or whether or not the smartphone makers are going to adopt the 5G radios. I think the bigger question is, what new applications, what new experiences, what new use cases are going to come out of this development. But as has always been the case with all of these major generational changes, we have to see that the change happen first before we can see what people do with them. And that's exciting to me to see what's going to happen. In other news, there was one little tidbit of Google, kind of Google specific news this week. And that was, I forgot who it was exactly that came on stage. I'm going to find their name because Sudhi Hurley. I hope I did not botch that name. I think I probably did. Head of Android platform security. He said on stage, or Qualcomm and him kind of jointly mentioned this thing that was first dug up by XDA developers in March of this past year and then mentioned by Google at Google I.O. this year, which is a much, much desired, much anticipated feature coming to Android R, which is Android Identity Credential APIs, which Qualcomm has basically announced that they're officially supporting with the Snapdragon 865, which will mean, hopefully, driver's licenses and passports, primarily probably just driver's licenses at first, yeah, will be digitized, hopefully, in the next couple of years, or at least be able to be digitized, which
it's, yeah, it's exciting. Yeah, it's who needs a wallet anymore? Who needs
cash? I think that's the main thing that's keeping people carrying debit cards around. At this point, Apple Pay and Google Pay have gotten adopted so widely that I think the main reason I still carry a wallet is because I have identity cards that I can't digitize. And if I'm going to carry my ID on me 24/7, I might as well carry all my cards to have in those backup moments where I can't use a, you know, digital payment. So yeah, that's cool. I think, am I correct to say that this was confirmation of this feature coming to Android R?
So at I.O., they did talk about it at I.O., but in terms of the timeline, we obviously did not see it with Android 10, Android Q. So R is definitely that's the next big opportunity to announce what is a splashy feature. Again, they have to get local government, state-level buy-in, but it's a start again. And European countries will most likely take the lead in this adoption of digital identity systems.
As usual, yes.
As usual.
Another really interesting thing that Qualcomm announced this week is this new fingerprint sensor. it was a little bit buried in the announcements on Tuesday. But they unveiled the 3D Sonic Max, which is a supersonic, 3D mapping fingerprint sensor, under-display fingerprint sensor, and it's 17 times bigger than the version that was it last year that they announced the 3D Sonic, I forgot what it's called, 3D Sonic sensor, and this one's called a 3D Sonic Max. You were here last year. Was last year the announcement for the original one? Do you know?
Yeah, last year was the original announcement, and we all saw how that went.
Yeah, that fingerprint sensor was kind of a massive failure, I think.
Yes.
And this version is 17 times bigger, and they showed a little bit of a graphic showing what that looks like, and it's basically like a third of your display screen. Obviously, that depends on the size of your screen. But it's a pretty good chunk of your screen can now sense your fingerprint through the display, which is an interesting development because we've seen Apple first was they decided to just leave fingerprint scanners behind and go full facial recognition systems, and then other makers have done various kinds of facial recognition systems, but not IR-based. And then Google is really the second major phone maker to do that. And now the rumor is that the S11 will also have an IR-based facial recognition system. But I guess the question now is, especially in light of the announcement of this fingerprint sensor, what is the new role of fingerprint sensors? And why is Qualcomm making this, if not that they already have commitments from many a smartphone maker that they will actually be able to sell it? That's my question.
Yeah, it's. I guess this goes back to the idea of choice, doesn't it?
I don't know if it does.
Yeah, because it's.
I mean, it's an aspect of it for sure.
It's an aspect of it. And yes, there's going to be, there's a physical impact of also including this new in display fingerprint technology. But at the same time, it will be really interesting if there are OEMs that are willing to reveal the usage face versus fingerprint when both of them are there and when both of the technologies are quite mature. I'm not sure which OEM would be willing to share that, but it's, the data will be interesting and honestly kind of help solve this debate once and for all. What is people's preference?
Yeah, and beyond preference, I mean, my view on the whole fingerprint versus facial recognition system thing has changed and evolved a little bit over the last 6 months. I mean, when I saw Apple do Face ID and got a chance to use it, I immediately said, okay, I see why they were confident enough to leave behind the fingerprint sensor, because once you get, I mean, once you kind of get used to the change, it's not even a concern. I mean, it's especially the most recent, I mean, they've slowly iterated on it over the last couple of years and it's gotten slightly faster and better and it works in more angles. And it's gotten to the point where I don't feel like I miss a fingerprint sensor as someone who uses Face ID all the time. However, over the last 6 months, my view on it has changed because I've realized that security on phones has always been, or at least ever since the addition of the fingerprint sensor, has always been a multi-layered system. It's always been, when fingerprint sensors came along, before fingerprint sensors, you could always do, I mean, on Android, it was usually a pattern of some kind or a code, a PIN code, or just a typed out password. And when fingerprint scanners came along, fingerprint scanners became the more convenient, faster, easier way of authenticating. But there was always the backup method. There was always the second layer to where if the fingerprint scanner became non-functional, because of a repair of the device was done, or if, you know, your fingers were dirty, or if you had gloves on, or, you know, whatever case it is, there was always a backup, and that backup was to just use the old way, right? The old way was using a pin, basically. And that's the way my view of this whole situation has evolved in the last 6 months, is that I think that's what's going to happen, that now that Apple and Google have proven out this facial IR-based system and proven, I think, objectively that it's better. I think it's objectively better enough that we could leave behind fingerprint scanners forever. But if you look at the backup methods, what is a better backup method? A PIN code or a secure, well done, convenient, easy to use in display fingerprint scanner? That's the way I see it. I see it now as, chances are at least in the coming years, if not already, that facial recognition system is going to unlock your phone before you even put your thumb on the screen. In most cases, I mean, I think that's the case on my iPhone, at least right now. Most of the time, the thing is already unlocked from my face before I've even touched the screen. I think that Apple was smart to not do the in-display fingerprint sensors while they were bad. And they still are bad, kind of, because this Sonic 3D Max, whatever, it's not out yet. We don't know how it's going to work. We don't know if it'll work. We don't know how well it'll work. That's TBD. But it seems like it's on a trajectory to getting good. At least that's what it seems like. Yeah. And so that's the question, is what's a better backup to Face? If Face is the fastest, easiest, most convenient, the most seamless, which I think is the long-term direction on all our devices. I've talked about this on the show many times. I feel like on phones, smart displays, we're kind of seeing a little bit of this on the Nest Hub Max already. And, you know, I think this will even be the case on smartwatches in the near future, where it's like, the seamless authentication will just be based on, you know, this artificial intelligence powered IR based, you know, facial recognition system. And I think fingerprint serves as a decent backup as long as it works well. And it seems like if 3D Sonic Max sensor works well, then great. If it's a cheap component, why wouldn't Apple throw it in? Why wouldn't Google throw it in? Why wouldn't all these makers throw it in as a you know, a backup to what seems to me will be the ubiquitous technology? What do you think about that kind of take on it? Does that strike you as, I mean, in addition to the choice aspect, which is also a thing too, I think some people might just prefer, for whatever their lifestyle is, maybe they, you know, maybe their job requires them to wear a mask or a hat or something that gets in the way of a fingerprint scan or a face scanner. Or maybe they just don't like the idea that every single thing in our life is going to be scanning our faces in 5 years.
Yeah.
You know,
I agree, like, that's good messaging.
Choice is an aspect, but yeah.
Yeah, but the,
do you think that's the reality of the situation?
Yeah, the solution you offered is good. It does really make sense in terms of giving people, in terms of making sure there's full coverage. There's, if face just doesn't work for you, then you can use your finger. Actually, just a small anecdote in using face unlock on the Pixel 4. I like it. It feels futuristic, all that, but I'm not sure about you or if this is a difference with Face ID on the iPhone, but I have to really look at it in a certain way, look at the Pixel 4 in a certain way to unlock it. Like, I feel like in the past month of owning this phone, I have a look for unlocking my phone. Well, not as much a look as like a facial position that I have to do.
Yeah.
And
yeah, that's actually, like, I mean, That's a perfect example for, I mean, you're hitting the nail on the head, and I will give you the exact anecdote, the exact perfect experience I've had with the iPhone and the Pixel 4, which I've used. And that is sitting and eating.
Mm-hmm.
That is one of the many cases where it would be really, really nice to have an in-display fingerprint scanner as a backup. I would say most of the time the face is better. Sitting and eating, whether this is a matter of the AI just not being good enough yet or whatever, I don't know. But sitting and eating, especially with food in your mouth, you know, it changes the shape of your mouth just enough. It's very subtle, but it's mm-hmm. just enough to where the face system thinks that it's a different face. And it's frustrating because it's like, okay, now I have to like shuffle the food around in my mouth and I need to put it like right in the middle in my teeth, so that it's not puffing out my cheeks or whatever. You know, it's like I have to kind of do one of these, like just like try to make a dull kind of just like blank face, like and the blank face is what's gonna catch it. So yeah, that's totally right. Absolutely perfect example. Like, there are so many, and that's not the only one. There's other experiences, other times where I've been like, oh, I wish I you know, 99% of the time the face ID is futuristic, seamless, works perfectly, and it's like magic. And then there's that other percent of the time where I'm like, if only it knew that my thumb was on my screen right now and that thumb was my thumb, I would not be frustrated and I would not be having to put on a poker face while I'm eating my dinner to unlock my phone.
Yeah.
Not that we should all be on our phones for every single meal, but but that's a reality I think that people have experienced. I haven't seen anyone write a Medium post about eating and face ID, and maybe I need to do it. Maybe I need to be the guy because that needs to be a Medium post that is written.
Yeah.
I guess I just wrote it. Maybe someone can just transcribe this and put it on medium.com/face ID while eating, and I'll share it. But so no, you're totally right. And I think that's it's a good point. And I think fingerprint sensors, contrary to my predictions a year ago, I think fingerprint sensors are going to continue to matter, and that will be because they will be used as primarily a backup. Going back to something I talked about a minute ago, Motorola announced that they're going into the premium smartphone space.
Yes, which is fascinating.
Again, which is the first time since the Moto Z, correct?
Yeah, basically. All those lackluster Moto Zs that one can barely remember on Verizon.
The most recent Moto Zs were not premium.
No, they're right. Not. They're all, they quickly went down to mid-range, which makes sense for them. I think at the keynote they cited they're profitable the last few quarters or something like that. And that's basically off their mid-range and low-end phones due to the success in that entry-level market. So them going, the thing about going back to the freemium market feels like you're chasing a reflection in the water. It's yes, it's aspirational. It's sexy making a premium phone. But at the same time, are they shooting themselves in the foot? And then there's, is the motivation?
My question is, can Motorola make a premium phone at all? Like, I feel like when Lenovo bought Motorola, Motorola as a brand kind of had a little bit of polish, you know? Like, Rick really made the brand stand out as even the phones that were not technically premium from a specs point of view, like the Moto X, like it was not premium. It had a mid-range, but the brand, like he had built a brand that I think was, I don't know what the right word to put on it. It was like, it's like Motorola almost had a veneer a veneer of quality and polish. And, that is, I think, inextricably linked to launching premium phones, or it's like it needs to be inextricably linked to launching premium phones. And Rick's kind of recreated that with the Pixel, I think, but it's just been more rocky for a lot of reasons. The smartphone space is just so different than it was when he was. It's like, this is such a sidebar, but it's like Rick is trying to redo what he did with Motorola with the Pixel. But the problem is that the smartphone space is completely different than it was 5 years before.
Yeah.
You know, he did Motorola for 5 years or whatever. And it's like the smartphone space was a completely different space. And so, and then he's leaving Pixel now. And it's like, he's trying to do the exact same thing he did with Motorola. And it's not working out as well, it seems like. But, anyways, that's a sidebar, and we'll get into that sometime probably in the future. But yeah, Motorola is like, it's like they're trying to, it's like, I don't know. It would be like if McDonald's decided to start selling a premium burger for $12.99, it's like, it's not compatible with what the brand is. If you want a premium burger, where do you go? Do you go to McDonald's? I think McDonald's they've even struggled with their like $5.99 burgers. It's like, I think they, for a while, they tried to make burgers that were like fresh frozen beef, and they couldn't sell them, you know? It's like, it's because, you know, people associate McDonald's with getting a 99 cent burger that's a piece of crap, and they go to Five Guys to get it for $7.99 or whatever. Like, that's just what the brand is. And Motorola for a while had a little bit of a reputation, I think, with being kind of finesse and premium, and now they've just totally destroyed that. Lenovo has totally destroyed that over the last 3 or 4 years. Mm-hmm. And now it's like, now you want to get back into premium phones? I don't see it.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's this week. I mean, that's pretty much the most noteworthy, newsworthy stuff that has come out of Tech Summit this week. Mm-hmm. For our audience, I guess there was XR2 was announced, which we just talked about this before the show. You guys missed this, but the XR1 we just realized, which I am so ashamed of myself because I was the Glass Reporter guy and I didn't realize this, but the XR1. Which was the last kind of augmented reality platform that Qualcomm launched, is the platform that the Glass Enterprise Edition 2 is based on. Mm-hmm. And today they just announced the XR2, which is the follow-up to that. So we might see Google launch the Glass Enterprise Edition 3 with the XR2 chip inside. That's a little bit of a alphabet scoop detail that you are not going to get from anyone else. So that's what happened this week. Everything else was pretty much irrelevant to us. However, I guess we'll spend the last 15 minutes talking about this. The biggest news of the week had nothing to do with Qualcomm, at least the biggest Google news. What was it?
So was it a Tuesday? Did it just happen on a Tuesday? Oh, I forgot how big. Was it Wednesday? I honestly forgot how days were.
It was yesterday. Right? What? It was the third, which was Tuesday, yeah.
Yeah, it's time Tuesday. For that circle. So on Tuesday, the founders, Google's co-founders, Larry Page and Sergey Brin, announced that they no longer want to be Alphabet's CEO and president, respectively. So the company they started, they officially do not have management roles in anymore. And to run the entire show now, they place Sundar Pichai, Google's current CEO, in charge of Alphabet. This parent company structure, which is home to Google, obviously, and other Waymo, which is doing self-driving cars.
Google and Waymo, that's it. That's the end of list. Google Ventures, Calico, not Life Sciences.
Verily Life Sciences.
Verily, yes, Verily Life Sciences. What else? What else is still alive?
So Alphabet Access, which is what Google Fiber is under.
Very confusingly, still.
Very confusing name. Chronicle, which is a cybersecurity startup, was just moved into Google Cloud. There's obviously X is operating under the Alphabet stuff. And they have robots, which they recently announced. But yeah, in terms of what we should, of like what is like profitable and approaching that, it's basically just Waymo, maybe soon with self-driving taxis. And to a lesser degree, Verily Life Sciences, because biomedical is a very hot field. But besides that, there's also Wing, which drone deliveries could be a thing going forward. They launched in the US in Virginia, I believe, a few weeks ago.
Their spin out from X seemed premature to me.
I think we're kind of there yet. But at the same time, it could also be preemptive to make sure Amazon doesn't get there first and shapes a narrative. So that could be another thing there. But yeah, all these things, Sundar Pichai is now in charge of while also managing Google. And that is so...
Which, if we're honest, was probably already true.
Already true.
I mean... I get the read that Sergey and Larry have kind of been on checked out for a while now.
Yeah.
And really this organization has really been a title in the first place. Like it's really been, I don't know. Like, it's like we've just seen more and more over time that this whole structure has collapsed and, I don't know. It's like, yeah, exactly. And it's like, who's really calling the shots on things? And I think the answer has been Sundar for a while, probably.
Yeah, when Matha is with Google,
right? And the way the shots he was calling was, let's just bring it back under me. If I'm going to be the one calling the shots, we need to move it back under Google, basically.
Yeah. Which, in fairness, the statement Larry Page and Sergey Brin released said basically that Sundar is supportive of this structure, of this Alphabet structure, which could just be framing and stuff. But at the same time, it really does seem this is going to stay a bit. Not sure how. Again, like, if for the users of this stuff, it doesn't really matter who's calling the shots. There's a lot of criminology, there's a lot of investor stuff behind this Alphabet change, this stepping in place really for Sundar. But it is interesting and does speak to Sundar's epic rise to the ranks as somebody who started on the Google toolbar, which I don't think I ever used, or most people remember, to Chrome, to Android, to...
Did that ever come out for Firefox?
It's probably
IE.
Google Toolbar
come out for Firefox? I know it was IE, but I just can't remember if there was a Firefox version. I do remember using that.
Oh my gosh. Really?
but that's very vaguely. I don't remember anything specific. I couldn't tell you any dramatic stories about 10-year-old me using the Google toolbar, but I have a little bit of an idea of in my head, because there was a time that IE toolbars were, there's a meme going around. If you type in IE toolbar funny or something in Google Images, you'll find like an image of an IE window that has like 12 toolbars. It's like there's a Yahoo one, there's a Google one, there's an eBay one, there's like, at one point, every site had a toolbar.
Now imagine toolbars for your face, and then that's augmented reality for the first several years, but I digress.
Right.
Yeah. Anyways, yeah, Sundar, he's in charge. And again, like, I don't think we'll see any real impact, really. I very much doubt.
Two reasons. One being that Sundar was already calling a lot of these shots, probably. And so this change is actually probably more in line with what the reality of the situation already was. And two being that Larry and Sergey still have all the control, even though they're not managerial.
They kept their voting shares. They're still going to talk at Sundar. I'm pretty sure Sundar is going to take under strong advisement what Larry and Sergey say.
That's probably an understatement. Yeah, like Larry like calls Sundar and says, "Hey, Sundar, you need to buy Kitty Hawk and put it under Alphabet." And Sundar says, "Okay."
Yeah, Kitty Hawk.
For those who don't know, Kitty Hawk is Larry Page's little hobby product. Yeah.
Which I don't want to digress, but are flying cars really like a 10x idea? Are they really? The future. I never got flying cars. That said, well, it would be much easier.
One reason they might be.
Self-driving planes are easier than self-driving cars.
Right. That's what I was going to say. It would be easier for Uber to do self-driving human drones than it would be for them to do self-driving cars in the long run.
It's very counterintuitive, but if you think about it, there's less stuff to collide in the sky.
Right. Anyway. Yeah, and it's much easier to just map 3D space and make sure that two things that you're mapping. So it's like the system would be mapping all of the objects in 3D space, and all the system has to do is make sure those objects never collide with one another. versus the system on the ground, which is an object having to make sure it doesn't collide with a million potential variables that are uncontrollable.
Funny enough that that collision system in space, in the sky, is something that Wing has. Besides, they have guidance systems to manage like everything in the sky, which is funny. Would be hilarious if Kitty Hawk and Wing somehow did something together.
I can't wait for like 5 years from now, we're going to pull up this episode and be like, wow, Abner, very prescient of you. you called the Wing Kitty Hawk merger way early.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's Alphabet. And finally this week, there were some random Google Pixel things that I didn't follow because I've been here and not there.
I guess let's end this episode by pulling one out for the original Pixel, which should have received its last update with the December security patch. It was start, I guess. I guess we can call it that. Still my favorite design, honestly, in terms of like unique. Especially that blue one.
Yeah. And in its time, coming a year before kind of the bezel-less phone revolution.
Yeah, that's still old. When it was
yes, it did.
It had less pressure too.
Yeah. I mean, if you really look at it, I think if you look at Pixel design relative to the rest of the smartphone space, let's say Samsung. Pixel design relative to Samsung design in 2016 has the relativity, has the degree to which Pixel looks old. Has that changed since then? I don't think so. I think that it looks exactly as old compared to the current Samsung designs in 2019 as it did for the original. Because if you look up, what was it, the Samsung, was it the S7 that came out in 2016? Galaxy Phone 2016.
S6, I think, right?
Galaxy S6 was announced the S6 was in 2015. The S7 was in 2016. S7. So the Galaxy S7 was, I guess, the Edge. The Galaxy S7 Edge, that was the big phone that year. See, yeah, like comparing the I mean, the bezels are almost the same size, honestly. So it looked older than everything else on the market in 2017, but it didn't look that much older. And I would say that's still true. The Pixel 4 still looks older. It looks about a year older than everything else on the market. And that's probably about the same as the original Pixel did. So Google's staying consistent with being a year behind. So I guess we know exactly what next year's phone will look like. next year's phone will be small. So it'll be like this year's phone, but it'll be a small notch instead of the big bezel on the top. It'll be like an iPhone 10 size notch this year. Or next year, I mean.
We'll take what we can get. Sadly.
Yeah. Because they're definitely going to do facial recognition again. Also, do you think they're going to call it the Google Pixel 5G?
Oh, gosh. People wanted PIX3L, which never happened, by the way, for the Pixel 3.
There's no chance for that. No chance.
I don't think they're doing Pixel 5G. That's a horrid name.
Well, maybe they'll do Pixel 5 and Pixel 5 XL with the 765 mid-range at $500. And they'll do Pixel 5G with the 865. I don't know. That wouldn't make sense because the 765 would also be 5G. I don't know. Well, our conversations have derailed. What were you going to say?
I would say, I would actually give more credence, more applause to any phone maker that doesn't really talk about 5G in the next year.
Yeah, because you're just misleading buyers.
Yes.
If you make it the center of your pitch next year, then you're just talking about something that's not real. Anyways, I'll leave the show with one last headline, with one last story, and that is that Google Photos has a messaging app now. And that's the end of the show. We'll see you next week. Thanks, Sabra, for joining me. You can find us on all your favorite podcasting platforms, such as Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify, and everywhere else. And we'll see you next week.